Hello and welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I'm John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I am John Ash.
With us this week is Bruce Eckel. Bruce has published 10 books, numerous blog posts, over 150 articles, and has given hundreds of presentations. Welcome, Bruce.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, so before we get started, would you just like tell us a little bit about yourself, possibly sort of how, what brought you into this industry in the first place?
Well, I got started, I guess there was some dabbling in the initial years in high school and in college. But I guess I'd say what really got me here was an attempt to stay in college for as long as possible, because I really didn't want to join the real world, because my perception of it was being stuck in a cubicle and having somebody tell you when you had to be sitting in your cubicle and when you could go home. And I really didn't want anything to do with that. And back when I was going to school, it was still, I mean, effectively free. It cost a little something, but you could just keep going if you wanted to. And so that's what I was trying to do. And when all of my physics friends went off to graduate school, I said, oh, is that the next thing to do? And so I ended up in graduate school that became a degree in computer engineering, and which was all hardware stuff. But eventually I started focusing more and more on software, because that's where a lot of the demand was.
So did you enjoy the hardware, or did you enjoy the software better?
Well, my first book is called Computer Interfacing with Pascal and C. And that was all about how to interface your computer with the outside world. And it was based on a series of articles that I had written, a column for a magazine that is long defunct called Micro Cornucopia, which is published out of Bend, Oregon. And that's more or less how I ended up here in Crested Butte. My editor there was involved with the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory up here. So that's how I got to know the place.
Okay. So what do you do these days? What are you working on?
Well, for the last couple of years or so, I've been working on a book called Atomic Kotlin. And JetBrains approached me because they had liked the book, the format of the book for Atomic Scala. And they were hoping that I would do something for Kotlin. And they provided me with one of the people who was part of the core Kotlin development team, Svetlana Isakova, who's Russian, because they're all over there in St. Petersburg, and really smart people. Anyway, so we've been working on this book for the last, at least couple of years. So that's probably, and the website's been up for a while. It's atomickotlin.com, and there's a early access version of that book that's available now. And we're, trying to keep our heads down working on it, but it's always a long process to do it right.
For those who people who aren't familiar with Kotlin, would you kind of like give us the little pitch of what is it and why is it sort of useful?
So the thing that I really like about Kotlin is that the team explicitly decided to go looking. It's what you would think all programming languages would do, but they were very much more careful about this. And they said, we want to go find all of the good features in the other languages that have been proven to be good in practice. And those are the features that we're going to incorporate. We're not just going to willy-nilly throw a bunch of features that we think of off the, you know, off the cuff, put them in there. We want tested features. And so they've done that, basically acquired features and strategies from other languages. And then there have been a couple of small features that they decided to put in on top of that, which I think makes sense in this case. But by and large, if you're coming from another language, there are parts of it that look like your language. So that's what I would say is the best part about it, is that everything is tried and tested and not just thrown in or not thought about. I mean, like when you look at Java, well, they've got the declaration syntax, which prevents type inference. And they use semicolons everywhere and on, all these things. And they just took that from C++, which took it from C, which, you know, they weren't really thinking about those things and how it would impact, at least in my opinion. Whereas with Kotlin, they thought about all of those things. And when you compare it to, say, a language called Scala, I tend to think of Scala as more of an experimental sandbox, and you can do all kinds of amazing things with it, but then there are features that where for example, let's experiment to see what happens if you can create your own overloaded operators and they can be as many characters long as you want. Okay, maybe that wasn't a good experiment, but now we know. And so, you know, we see all the things that go wrong with it and the relatively minimal benefits. So Kotlin uses operator overloading in the same way that Python does, which is that there's a limited number and there's a clear named function that's associated with an operator and all that. So that's kind of the short overview of what Kotlin's about.
Yeah, a few of the technologists that I follow on Twitter and listen to podcasts and so forth have nothing but great things to say about Kotlin. You know, making lists of why everyone should be using Kotlin or lists of reasons why I love Kotlin and things like that.
Yeah, and I mean, I've seen a lot of programming languages. That's kind of the thing that I guess I do. I sometimes wonder if I'm not a language usability advocate, you know, where, but which means I complain when language features seem dumb to me. But I keep being very impressed with the design decisions that they've made in Kotlin. Really quite impressed with it, which is saying a lot because I generally look for things that I assume that a language is going to have glaring flaws. And so I go find them because I feel like in thinking in Java, that's what I did most for the reader, is to point out problems with the language so that when they encountered it, they weren't sitting there thinking, well, what's the matter with me? Why do I feel dumb because this feature doesn't seem very good? So I explain, well, here's why that feature isn't very good. So you don't need to feel dumb.
So then how does it relate to Java? I guess it just compiles down to something that runs on the JVM, or what? How does that work?
I think initially that's what they were going for. They were saying, let's take a language that will, and I could totally see, you know, unless something even better comes along, I could totally see this replacing Java because it solves so many of the problems that are entrenched in Java that just can't be fixed in Java. It started out that way, but now they have the native code. So Kotlin will compile to native code. And so you can create an executable that doesn't require the JVM to start up. And this allows a whole bunch of other things to happen. So it is not tied to the JVM, but they designed it to interact really well with Java so that if you're starting to move to Kotlin, you don't have to say, oh, well, we have to throw away all of our Java code and rewrite everything in Kotlin. You can rewrite little pieces of it, and it works very well. Yeah, it plays extremely well with Java, and they designed it to do that.
Okay, so then what's the book sort of going to be entailing? What's the purpose of the book, the main purpose?
I made a mistake. Well, I guess I don't know if it's a mistake, but anyway, like in thinking in C++ and thinking in Java, I assumed that my readers would be professional programmers who've had some kind of background and they wanted to learn a new language. Then over the years, what I found out was that a lot of people were using these books as their first exposure to programming. And it was like, oh, oops. Okay. So with the Atomic Kotlin, what we're doing is trying to work with both kinds of readers. If you're a beginner, you go through all of the initial material. If you're an experienced programmer, there are two summary, we call them atoms. That's why it's atomic. And the idea was to make the chapter so small that they cover ideally just one thing. So you get a sense of satisfaction very quickly. Because, you know, when you're trying to slog through all this stuff, you need as many endorphin hits as you can possibly get. So, but there are two atoms which summarize things. And so if you're an experienced programmer, you can go to those. And then everybody's on the same page from then on. And that's kind of the general idea of the book.
Have you always organized your books into small chapters and writing them, or are you finding that to be an easier way of developing the book in addition for the person who's consuming it?
It is, because for the same reason that the person who's reading it ideally has this experience of going, oh, I finished a chapter. I know a new thing. I've got a new atom of knowledge in my head. It turns out that it's easier for me to go through, because you may have heard the phrase, writing is rewriting. So that means it's like you, every time you think it's done, then you go back and you edit it and you find all kinds of things that need to be changed and fixed, et cetera. So having the smaller chapters, the very small chapters, helps me because I get that same sense of satisfaction when I can get through one and go, oh, this is done. Or at least I am now under the illusion that is done until the next time that I look at it.
So do you find yourself like, okay, you go back to rewriting that chapter and all of a sudden you realize, oh, wait, there's some other piece of explanation that needs to be written. And then that becomes sort of its own chapter. Or how do you handle those situations?
That often happens with the small... with the small units, it's a little easier because we don't, it was, say with the Java and C++ books, that would happen within a chapter and we go, oh, I didn't explain this. I need to add a whole new thing. And sometimes weeks would be involved in the research and development of that section. Whereas here we can say, all right, we need to create a new atom. And then, like right now, we decided that we were kind of overreaching and that there were issues like concurrency, which is very important in Kotlin and kind of in the modern world, because Kotlin uses coroutines. And it would be great to explain it, but my co-author pointed out that, yeah, that's probably a little too hard. And I realize that, because when you're talking about concurrency, it isn't just adding a feature. You're stepping into an entirely different world where everything that you thought was one way is now affected by concurrency. And so, yeah, that's just been a long-term struggle for me as well, is how do I thoroughly understand concurrency well enough to explain it?
So in trading emails, you mentioned that you accidentally started a consultancy.
Yes. There's a university in Gunnison, which is about 30 miles away. I started interacting with one of the students in the computer science department. And when he graduated, he's kind of like the way I was when I graduated from school, which is he didn't want to join the rat race either. So he said, is there some way I could work for you? And I thought, well, okay, let's see what we can do. And so we kind of muddled about for a while. Fortunately, he was still in cheap college student modes and, you know, wanting to enjoy life more than working at a job. So, then a customer came along, and then just this last April, his, Cody's, college friend and lab partner graduated, and he wanted to do the same thing. So it sort of kind of happened. And I have been studying alternative organizational structures and systems for, I don't know, for maybe 10 years, and, you know, reading books on management and things like that, which mostly aren't helpful, but finally came across as something that is really useful. So I've been pondering, well, how do I create an organization like this? And this is one of my downfalls. I tend to ponder and say, well, maybe there's a little bit more research we can do. I know right around the corner, there's going to be the answer, rather than doing experiments. And I know this, but it's still hard to get me to do it, because, you know, there's this idea, there's this illusion that you can make the right decision the first time and not do the experiments. So anyway, by these guys showing up, I said, all right, I guess we're doing the experiment now. And it's actually been really good so far. I mean, we only have one customer so far, but we're starting to look for others. And our customer is really happy. And the kind of, I guess, one of the core foundations of this experiment is to say, well, what happens if we try and optimize programmer happiness? And a big part of that is being able to work when you're inspired to, when you want to, and not work more hours because there's urgency and there's schedules and things like that. We don't do that. We go, when you want to work, work. When you feel inspired to, when you don't, stop, because you're not going to be very good at doing whatever you're doing it when you're just working because of urgency and not because of inspiration.
The favorite organizations that I've worked for seem to adopt a similar philosophy of, we want to create an atmosphere or a company or an organization where we want to work.
Mm-hmm.
Have you found there's any magic bullet, or is that the same type of thing you're talking about?
Well, I think it is, but organizations have been saying that kind of thing for a long time. And unless you have the structure, at one point our customer was getting a little anxious about, it was going, oh, I'd like these features to be put in faster. Isn't there some way you can get person to work more? And I said, absolutely not. And that has to be, something like that has to be the foundation. You can't have something where somebody can come along and they go, oh, but this is special, this is urgent, we need to do more, and we need to add pressure and things like that. And it's like, no, that's not what I want in my life. I mean, and that would require me to be watching and saying, well, are you working enough? And I don't have to do that. And so that makes this organization viable for me, because I don't get that kind of homework. My role is a coach and consultant. So if they get stuck in something or they need help, then they come to me for that. And then there's the organizational stuff, which we're trying to put into place. But my hope would be, one of the things that we do is to create kind of a template for a software organization. It's called the Teal Model, and it comes from a book called Reinventing Organizations by Frederick Laloux, Laloux. And he's got a bunch of videos, and I mean, you can find various things, but the book itself is will kind of guide you through this and give you the perspective which I was looking for 10 years. So, but a big part of it is that it takes the pressure off of me, because I don't have to be like in charge of making sure schedules happen. it turns out I thought, hey, what if we never thought about this? And then somebody pointed out to me, oh, there's a movement. It's called the basically the point is to try and remove all kinds of pressures that really don't help. I mean, if you think about it, well, so you schedule something. Well, what does that mean? You know,
right.
The schedule isn't going to happen. We don't. There's a great book called Waltzing with Bears by the same people who wrote Peopleware. And one of the things it points out is every time you do a schedule, you're always taught, you're saying, well, if this goes right and this goes right and this goes right, then we'll meet this. And the possibility of any of those things happening is they look at everything as a curve, as a probability curve. And schedules are based on the very leading edge of the probability curve. Let's assume that the best things happen. Well, that's a 0% chance. And, you know, what you really need to do is find yourself in the middle of that curve.
Right.
And even then, it's still probabilities. And so this idea that we go, let's stop wasting our time doing this and spend our time actually building software. It appeals to me because the whole scheduling thing just seems like kind of a waste of time.
So many companies say, okay, well, we tried waterfall and that didn't work for us. Now we're going to try agile and that's going to be the magic bullet. And we're going to do Scrum because we have standups and we're going to spend time and put in estimates on backlog items. And we're going to devise a schedule and we're going to predict so many points delivered in a particular sprint and we can deliver faster and do all these things when fundamentally they're misunderstanding the point, I think, and looking to predict something that's utterly unpredictable.
Yeah, and Agile is meant as a communication tool. I'm really sorry. I was invited to go to that initial Agile thing in Utah, and I was used to having people pay me to travel and do things. And so it was like, what? Go and pay my own way? No, absolutely. You know, now I would absolutely do that. I've done all that kind of stuff now to the point where, oh, that sounds like a non-boring opportunity. So I'm sorry I missed that. But yeah, it was meant as a communication tool. But then in combination with all my study of management and structures and things like that, I realized that, well, that'll only take you so far. When you're talking to people who are fixated on the idea of trying to control things, which a hierarchy is intended to produce consistent products. It's designed for a repeatable process. And that's one of the nice things about the Reinventing Organizations book, is that it takes you through this history of organizational structures, and it's kind of like evolution, where they say, well, we evolved from monkeys, so why are there still monkeys? It's the same thing. Well, yes, these organizational structures evolved from previous ones, but those previous ones still fit a need, and so they still exist. But we're trying to get to this more advanced organization, which to me, the biggest aspect of it is the ability to innovate. And when an existing hierarchy whose goal, which a lot of people don't understand, the goal is to keep everything the same, and then they declare that, well, now we're going to be innovative. It doesn't, you can't just decide you're going to be innovative and have it happen. There's a description, maybe you guys can remember what it is, where your software looks like the structure of your organization. So this is kind of the same thing, where your organization, because every time I want to do an experiment, it needs to go up the flagpole, and the people higher up in the organization want to make sure that the experiment succeeds. But then it's not an experiment, because an experiment has to, you know, if you're experimenting right, you're failing a lot and you learn a tremendous amount from those failures. But if you have to ask, you know, if you have to get management approval for every experiment that you do, then you can't experiment, because they go, well, I don't want failures on my list of successes. It's a real problem, because I think if you bring Agile, or let's say the Agile mindset. It doesn't necessarily have to be those particular practices, but just the idea that, well, we don't have answers, and then you put it in an organization that says, well, we have to have answers, then you're fighting. You're at loggerheads. It's not going to work. And the person with the power is the one who says, we have to have answers. And so that reverts the organization away from Agile. So I think that's another step we have to take before Agile, or let's just say better software development, can happen.
Yeah, no, I think I really like what you're saying here. It seems like it. I think people, if we would talk, like, look back on like the Teal organization that you're sort of striving towards, a lot of people would look at that and go, well, you don't have the structure, you don't have, you know, where is that going to be to help hammer home the consistency? And it's not that isn't there. You're relying on your people to bring that themselves. And so whereas like most organizations rely on a structure, they basically say, we can't rely on our people, we have to rely on a structure that keeps our people in place to provide that consistency. You're saying, no, the people are innovators, and so we need to rely on our people to hold that structure and hold that consistency, which does put you in a big position to say, okay, well, I need to get the right people. We need to make sure that our people are motivated, and this wouldn't work for just anyone necessarily doing that. But at the same time, maybe there's a lot more people out there that would be unlocked by that sort of a model, where they're opened up and they actually have the means to control their destiny, to organize themselves, to be relied upon and whatnot. And then that would actually give them the ability to sort of outperform maybe even what they're doing today, because they're being locked down inside of this structure that's kind of keeping them closed in. And that's really kind of an interesting thought. And I think it's a scary thing for a lot of things. I think it's really cool what you're doing.
And culturally, when you start looking at this, because if I explain it, there was one time when I was going to visit Zappos, which is one of these Teal organizations. I mean, they went through something called Holacracy, and I took the Holacracy training, and that was valuable, but it wasn't quite what I wanted. And the same thing happened to Zappos. And anyway, there was a group of us going to go. They will give you a tour and answer questions and things like that. So if you're in Las Vegas, I would highly recommend taking the Zappos tour, because you kind of get some insights on it. But one of the, these were the city attorneys for Las Vegas. And one of them said, well, who tells you what to do? And of course, you know, and then you realize, okay, we've been acculturated from birth to have to say, well, somebody's got to tell you what to do. And when you have a flat organization, that doesn't happen. And so, yes, it's confusing at first, and it's scary. And if you've, you know, gone through management training and you go, well, I need to be the boss. I mean, even in this organization that I'm creating, I have to consciously say, how do I remove myself from the position of being the leader or boss or whatever it is? Because A, that's not what I want to be, and B, I don't want to accidentally fall into that because of my cultural training.
So one of the things that we ask everyone that comes on is if they would just sort of give some advice and speak to our listeners who are maybe just getting started, and they're just heading out there, or maybe they're someone who is trying to sort of level up in their career and take it to the next level. Do you have any like words of wisdom or piece of advice that you would hand it to those people specifically?
Our field, more than anything, is a constant learning field. And yeah, you guys are nodding, but you're doing a podcast, right? So you're like in the midst of it. And I write books, and I go to, I mean, I was involved in organizing the software development conference, and I do my own small conferences here and events and stuff. So we think, oh, of course, you're always learning. But apparently, and I just hear this as stories because these aren't the people who show up anywhere. Apparently, there are a lot of people who have their college textbooks and they've learned whatever they learned in college and they don't learn new things. And I don't meet these people except on very rare occasions, you know, special circumstances. So the attitude that one needs to have, I think, in this field is that, yeah, it's just learning is what you do. You don't ever stop and just use it. And if you do, I mean, there are people in our field who are automating everything. And that's really what should be done. You know, I mean, leveling up is what we always want to do. And by that, I mean using more and more powerful tools. Like, for example, I don't know if you guys have looked at Julia at all, but I am currently fascinated with Julia because it looks like, oh, this is solving all of those problems that I've been struggling with for many years, but where you don't have to think about it. You don't have to think about the concurrency and stuff. So it's like, that's to me the biggest part. And how to do that is, well, yes, there's books, but I mean, YouTube videos are just awesome. Podcasts can often be great. And then sometimes going to actual events like, say the Python conference. That's something that I've gone to and spoken at for 20 years at least. And on and off. And then, I don't know, I look for other interesting events. The kind of events that I hold are more interactive. And so the goal, again, is for me to get out of the way and for people to be able to communicate with each other. So we do these open spaces events. And they're like all open spaces, not some speaker and then some open spaces stuff. And that kind of, you know, people begin to understand how valuable it is to communicate with each other and how you're surrounded by people who typically know a bunch of stuff that if you get into conversation with, and I've also been experimenting with developer retreats where people just come up and we go, we have no plan. We always end up doing something interesting, but I've been trying to reduce the structure for everything. So it's like, hey, if you need to take a nap, take a nap, you know, do whatever it is that you need to do and you're better for it. You know, you're more interactive. Yeah. You're more, you know, rather than saying, oh, I have to stay awake because we're doing a thing now. So that kind of like seeking and meetups and all that kind of stuff, you know, kind of get out and interact and learn new languages and learn new technologies and stuff. It's really what we do, because ideally the amount of time that you're actually building stuff goes lower and lower.
What about any resources? Would you point people to any resources? Maybe they're working, trying to get Teal organization. We have talked about Kotlin, getting started. What do you have any particular things that you would say, hey, this is something that someone should check out?
Yes. If you go to, well, for Teal organizations, if you go to the website reinventingorganizations.com, just Google for it. I did a blog for many years, which is still up there, called reinventingbusiness.com. But he was thinking even bigger, so he got reinventing organizations in. Limitations. But Kotlin has a lot of really good online resources. And there's a lot of YouTube videos. The conference is coming up on its third year, I think, now. And that's in general what I've been kind of amazed by, is how many good, if you go onto YouTube and you search for this or that, and it's often a great way to get started on, like, I don't know anything about this language. Well, you start watching some YouTube videos and then you can, you know, it's, the effort is low there. Python has got tons, you know, all of the lectures from the Python conferences ever since they started doing it a number of years ago are up on, you know, available on YouTube. And also for Python, there's all kinds of good local resources And for women wanting to get into programming, they have things that are specifically good for women, like there's Pi Ladies and there's Django Girls. In fact, one of the best introductions to programming is supposed to be the Django Girls tutorial. I haven't taken it myself, but the fact that it's kind of making it more comfortable for women to get in, and you know, that's a whole nother issue in our field, is we have problems there, but it's getting better, and the Python community is really doing a good job of that. I kudos to Guido for taking the lead there.
What if people want to just sort of follow you, or is there social media, or you had mentioned that you used to have a blog? What?
Oh, I still do. I keep moving. Well, there's different blogs, but I keep moving my kind of main blog to different technologies. So you find a trail of it that goes way back. But now I'm using a static site generator, Hugo, and a nice theme. And anyway, it's just under my name, bruceeckel.com. And that also has links to the MindView website. And that's got a bunch of things that if people are looking for resources, you can find them on the MindView website. And but if you just go bruceeckel.com, that'll take you to the blog.
And then lastly, are there any speaking engagements or anything like that you have coming up that you'd like to...
Let's see, what do I have coming up? Let's see. No, nothing coming up. And if there is, I will put it on the MindView website. I mean, I think the last speaking engagement I did was in Poland in May. And summer in Crested Butte is really nice. And so it's hard to leave and go where it's hot. It's beautiful up here in the summer, so. I usually just wait for conferences to contact me. It's easier that way.
Well, thanks, Bruce. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks. It was fun.
That was Bruce Eckel. Bruce has published 10 books, numerous blog posts, over 150 articles, and has given hundreds of presentations. He creates and runs small conferences and provides training and consulting in programming languages and system design. He also created Evolve Coworking in Crested Butte, Colorado.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I am John Ash.